Hey, this is Mike Evans. Listen to every episode of Schlereth and Evans on demand at 1043thefan.com. Presented by Siltahara Motors, the home of the zero down with Chapter 7 and 13 bankruptcies. Regardless of your financial standing, no one should be without a vehicle. Visit the special financing section at sthmotors.com.
I am doing question mark, Millennial Ben.
Question mark is presented by Brakes Plus, and Mark, here's my question for you. When we look at what happened with the Avs after starting off 2-0, who's to blame for what could be considered an epic collapse? Is it just the fact that the Knights were just that much better than the Avs, or players didn't show up? Or does it fall on the shoulders of one Jared Bednar?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people that will sit there and point the finger at the coach because that's the easiest thing to do. I mean, we do it all the time, right? Well, it was Vance Joseph. He's terrible. Oh, when Gary Kubiak was here, I mean, there were a ton of people who were like, Gary Kubiak's horrible. Like, that offense is antiquated, even though, you know, there's a bunch of teams in the league that run that exact offense, right? Variations of that offense. So, yeah, everybody, I think pointing the finger at the coach is the easiest scapegoat. Because you know, you're fans. You don't want to point the finger at the players. You don't want to point the finger at the people picking personnel. You just don't want to. I understand that aspect of it. I also look at size, physicality, I mean, depth. I think all those things in regards to the Avs, I think the Knights are better built that way. Now, you can argue their top players, you know, their top three or four players, you can say, hey, the Avs are better. You know, I mean, when you look at Nathan MacKinnon, he's one of the top one or two players in the league. I get that. But when you look at four lines of depth and you look at five legitimate kind of big defensemen that will mix it up, you know, and we've got, I don't know how big Girard is, but I think, you know, off skates, he looks like he's about 5'6". You know, I mean, I just think there's a different mentality, or there's a different body type, and there's just a difference that wins in the playoffs. I think that part is important. I think when you look at how the Avs have been constructed, as great as they are athletically, as well as they skate, there's a toughness, size/toughness element that just seems to be missing to me on the roster construction.
So would it be fair to say this, since we don't want to, you know, throw Jared Bednar under the bus and just totally blame him, because like you said, that would be low-hanging fruit. Now let's look at a position that is all important, playing the goalie. The way that I look at it is almost like the quarterback in the NFL. We just say, well, you can't win without having a competent quarterback play.
Right.
So let's look at the goalies. You know, you look at Philip Grubauer and compare it to Marc-Andre Fleury. Is it Grubauer's fault that the Avs find themselves now out of the playoffs?
No, I don't think so. I mean, when you look at these, you know, when you look at just game number six, and just kind of how things go. I mean, you know, hits were pretty even. The Knights blocked 34 shots. The Avs blocked 18 shots. That's big bodies camping in front of their goaltender, you know, sacrificing themselves. Avs took 33 shots. The Knights only took 23. So, you know, I understand that we can point the finger at Grubby, but I just think it goes a lot deeper than that. And again, you know, I have these philosophies that not a lot of people enjoy, because it's not fun or sexy, or it doesn't it doesn't fill up the fantasy tally sheet, the stuff that I like, right? I just know that it wins. And, I mean, come on. I mean, like, when you can, when, like, size, or, like, quickness and speed and all that stuff is great, and it wins a lot of regular season games, it does not seem to translate in hockey to playoff hockey. And I think that's what we've seen the last couple of years. And there may be an outlier or two but for the most part, it doesn't. It's the same thing I think about in the NFL. Everybody likes, hey, we got to get, you know, a dynamic wide receiver, and we got to get fast, and we got to get this, and we got to get that. And it's all about, you know, filling up your fantasy tally sheet. But when push comes to shove, show me the team that dominates both lines of scrimmage. I'll show you a team that wins 85% of the games, 90% of the games. It's just a fact. And it was a fact, you know, you go into a game in Seattle with the Rams playing a backup quarterback from Lord knows where. It gets knocked out, and then they have to bring in their starting quarterback who had thumb surgery 11 days earlier. And they blow Seattle off their home turf. Why? Because they just ran it down their throat. What's the running back's name? Cam Akers?
Yeah.
I mean, has 100 and whatever. It's 50, 60 yards. I mean, they're just ripping runs. They are completely, and setting up easy play action stuff for their quarterback. I mean, it's a domination of line of scrimmage football. And you know, that to me, there's a correlation there. Whether it's basketball, whether it's hockey, whether it's football, it all correlates.
Well, it definitely all correlates. And, you know, really quickly with the Avs, it makes me wonder, going back to that Blues series, when Kadri was tossed out of the game, and he was a guy that was expected to come back had the Avs won last night. How big was that suspension? And as we look back and say, okay, well, we would love to point the finger as we try to figure things out. Well, why did this happen? Well, the Avs could have won if this would have, you know, the puck would have gone in this particular direction. But I go back to Kadri in that suspension.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he was a part of this team, now the physicality that we saw from the Knights, the Avs would have actually had it, and that would have helped out that top line for the Avs. Do you look at it the same way, say, if he's never suspended, now the Avs, looking back, hindsight being 2020, they have a chance to be more physically dominating in the series against
right.
the Knights.
Yeah, I think it helps. I don't think it changes. I don't think it changes the outcome. But I just don't think that it would change the outcome of what inevitably happened, which was, you got out hit, I don't want to say out hustled, but out fought in the corners and on the boards for the puck. The dirty work aspect, I hear analysts say this all the time, is that speed and athleticism and all that stuff, it matters like in the regular season. But when you can't use it because the other team can lean on you, can wipe you out, can shut you down because of size and physicality, then it doesn't benefit you to be able, like, you can't skate around, you know, and go tape to tape from guy to guy. You can't do that if people are leaning on you and they're eliminating that ability. So, you know, it's like for you, like as a defensive back, you know, if there's a guy like Revis back in the day, Revis Island, like if you put Revis one-on-one in a static formation and he's on, let's say, your Z receiver, right? And he's lined up in press. Man, his hands were so good. His feet were so good. He'd stymie you on the line of scrimmage. And if you line up and let him do that to you all the time, right, then shame on you. But now all of a sudden you can take that guy in short motion and get him in a stack and you're going to get a free release because he can't get on you that way, right?
Right.
So there's ways to combat that. But hockey-wise, like the Knights were just giving there is no free release. Like, they're on you. Their style just, I think, to me, matched up against the Avs. Their style just matched up well.
Well, there are a lot of Avs fans that are definitely frustrated about the outcome and how the postseason has gone for the Avs over the past couple of years. But there's one player for the Avs who's definitely frustrated.
For sure. I mean, there's always next year. It's always you talk about. I feel like, I mean, I'm going to my ninth year next year and haven't won, so I'm just definitely motivated. And I'm just, yeah, it just sucks, you know, losing four in a row.
Wait. When individuals talk about the Avs, you know, locally and nationally, they're always talking about how young this team is, the level of potential that they have, how great the top line is. But unfortunately, they just get to the postseason and can't get over the hump. So at what point will we actually see all of these things come together and come to fruition where all this young talent and potential actually turns into another Stanley Cup?
Yeah, you know, there comes a time when all that, like you said, the potential and the youth becomes, you know, aging veterans, right? And then
right.
All of a sudden you're like, uh-oh, we're not as youthful and as quick and as, like, when Nathan MacKinnon just said that, I'm entering my ninth year. Did I hear that right?
Ninth year.
I'm like, dude, how all of a sudden you're in year nine? At what point are you no longer the guy who is lightning fast on the ice, right? At what point do you all of a sudden lose a little bit of your athleticism advantage, your athlete advantage or your athletic advantage? Like, at what, year nine at 25 years old.
It's like aging dog years.
That's right. That's insane that you've played 9 years of professional hockey and you're 25 years old. I just think you have to really look at the teams that give you fits, why they give you fits, right? Why that matchup doesn't work, and how are you going to, with the talent that you have, how are you going to infuse in your team in the off season? Some things that will help you match up, or some players that will help you match up better with the Vegas Knights. Like, I think those are because right now you're good enough to get to the point where you've been getting, right? So now how do we get over the top? And, you know, I'm sure in your own career, Nick, like there are teams and there are schemes and there are guys that you just had their number, like you just matched up well against. And then there are teams and schemes and guys that you're just like, oh, shoot, this is going to be a long day, right?
Yeah. I've had those moments. Like, I go back to when I played here, and it's a Monday Night Football game. We're playing against the Chiefs. Trent Green is the quarterback, and I have, like, 30 yards in penalties myself,
mm-hmm.
right? Defensively, that's something that you never want to do. Coach Shanahan is definitely a little upset. He's not screaming, but he's got the red face.
Yeah.
So you know what the red face means, that
right.
He's highly upset with you. And it was one of those things. I came back, you know, the day after the game Monday, and I came to pick up my check. And, you know, my then coach, David Gibbs, was like, don't go pick up your check. Have you seen the film? And I'm like, I don't need to see the film. I played the game, so I know I didn't play well, but I'm still going to go pick up that check.
Yeah.
But it made me upset enough to know, not just that I played poorly, he knew it. And if he knew it, then the fans knew it as well. So the first thing I did, man, I picked up my check.
Yeah.
I don't want to leave that. So I went downstairs and I just started watching film again. And I watched every bad play that I had, because I say, well, I never want to be in this situation again, because it felt like crap, because David Gibbs, my DB coach, stops me in the hallway, not to say hello, but to tell me, and the first thing he said, you played like crap. Now I'm giving you the PC version of it, but it was just so deflating, especially for me being a guy who, you know, I had to grind to get into the league as an undrafted player, thinking that, okay, now I've made it, I've become a starter. Now my coach is still telling me I play like crap. So it's one of those things when I look at the Nuggets, when I look at the Avs, sometimes as a player, you have to look within yourself. You start to look at your career and say, well, how long have I been playing this game? You know, when will the light either go on for me or I put myself in a position to win a championship? And for me, that's where I was like, you know what? I need to go out and make sure that I never have this feeling again, that my coach never have to mention it to me again. But unlike you, you got a chance to go to, you know, a Super Bowl playing and several. So what was that like for you to know, okay, when you started your career, how you got into the league, and then finally you were able to be a part of something special where you were able to win a championship finally, and Nathan McKinnon, he doesn't really know what that's like.
Yeah, you know, I think there's, I mean, for me, you know, I was in my third year when I won my first championship, so I was still a really young player. But yeah, I would look at our team, like the team that I played on in Washington, where, you know, that team is considered one of the best Super Bowl teams in history. You know, probably had a top 10 or 5 offense, a top 10 or 5 defense, you know, probably a top rated special teams as well. I mean, we were loaded, but it wasn't star driven. You know, if you look at that team, the most famous aspect of that team was the Hogs, was their offensive line. And that's how that team was built. And so it just is it's a real kind of, again, interesting dynamic. I came into the league and I cut my teeth for a team that didn't believe in stars winning games, believed in physicality and toughness winning games. And so I was taught at a very early age that you want to win in this league, you have to dominate the physical aspect of football, right? And that has never left me. That has always been a philosophical approach. And as much as the game has changed, and there have been a lot of changes, to me, it hasn't changed at all in that toughness wins.
But that's a part of the physicality that when we look at the Broncos trying to set that identity and being able to impose your will on, you know, the opposition. I've been around some teams here in Denver and especially in New York, where it was all about establishing the run. With the Jets, I mean, you had, you know, Curtis Martin running the ball. And the whole idea was like, okay, well, you know, Vinny Testaverde is the quarterback. We establish the run that opens up play action, but we want to make the defense start to think about, hey, we need to stop to run. And if they're doing that, now you're talking about 8-9 men in the box. Mm. Wayne Corbett now as a wide receiver. No, he wasn't a really fast guy. He was really crafty. But because you have to creep the safety up, because you've already established the run, now that gives him opportunities to find open passing lanes. So I have to figure when you were playing with the Hogs and you were playing here with the Broncos, that was kind of the way of life, the way of thinking, right? Mm. The outside zone. Maybe run some wham plays or something like that, get into two tight end sets and just kind of grind teams out. Because I've always said this, Mark, we hear so much about the quarterback position, how important it is and having a passing game. But I'm like, man, there's nothing like establishing the run, because if you can get into your 4-minute offense, grind down opposing defense, and then you can chew clock but still put yourself in position to score at the end of that drive, to me, I thought that was important.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that it's an important aspect of football. And it's one of the reasons that I probably don't look at the quarterback position like a lot of people look at the quarterback position. You know, a lot of people want to make it all about the quarterback, and the quarterback is important. There's no question. It's a tough position to play for sure. So it's an incredibly important position, but at the same, I always looked at it as a team oriented game, and kind of, you know, my roster building kind of concept is if we're really good everywhere, we can help groom a quarterback, help bring a quarterback along. We can, you know, we can grow a guy. And so that was always kind of a philosophy. Now, listen, like in Washington, we had Ricky Sanders and, you know, Art Monk, Hall of Famer, and Gary Clark. We're pretty damn good there, right? Tight ends, we had guys that would just, I mean, the guys were like offensive tackles. Donnie Warren was one of the best blocking tight ends in the history of football. Ronnie Middleton was a physical freak. You know, Terry Orr could play. Like, we had guys. Ernest Byner is one of the best football players I've ever played with. Forget running backs, just one of the best football players, Gerald Riggs. So we had really good players. You know, Mark Rip was our quarterback. Rip was great. You know, played with Doug Williams. Doug was great. But it wasn't, we didn't rely on that. We relied on, we're going to run the ball down your throat. We're going to set up the physicality aspect of football. We're going to play the same way on defense, and we're going to wear you out. And in doing that, we're going to get big plays over the top. You know, we're going to get big plays in the passing game. But that's what we're doing first and foremost. And I've always adhered to kind of that philosophical approach to the way football should be played. And so the same thing can be said to me when it comes to the Avalanche. I mean, it's clear you lost because from a size, physical nature, and just rotation, just you don't match up well. And I think one of the things Michael Malone is saying is, hey, man, I know we didn't shoot the ball well, but what I'm really disappointed in is we didn't do the dirty work stuff that's imperative to winning. We didn't give full effort on the defensive end like the Suns did. We didn't do those things. And that's what hurts. Like, that's what the disappointing part is. Hey, Liz, man, you know this as a defensive player. It's one thing to get beat over the top for a 78-yard touchdown, right? And you're like, shoot, I screwed that up. Like, I jumped the smash and they ran a post over me and I was supposed to have some depth and help my corner out and that's on me and I'll raise my hand. Whatever, right? And, I mean, it hurts, but it's not painful, right?
Right, right.
But if we line up and go 5 yards, 4 yards, 7 yards, 3 yards, 9 yards, you know, and it's nine straight runs, and we cram it down your throat and your tongue is hanging out, and we just keep pounding you, that is demoralizing to a defense. That is when a defense just throws up their hands and goes, we can't stop them. And that, giving up a score like that on that type of drive, I know is a lot more painful than giving up the 78 yarder over the top where you can go, you can say, ah, man, we busted that coverage, man. We're better than them still. But the opposite of that, when you get physically beat down, it's demoralizing. I mean, I played defense. I know what it feels like, right?
Right.
That both those things happen. And it's when you can, and as an offense, when you can put that on people and you can see, you're just like, we are absolutely just thunder punching you clowns right now. That's demoralizing. That hurts.
It is, as a defensive player and a guy coaching this league, it is demoralizing to watch a team take a ball down the field, maybe on a 10, 12 play drive.
Right.
And half of those plays are running the ball. You know it's coming, and you still can't stop. And you got defensive players looking at each other with their hands up, and no one has answers. It is tough, and that's why it's all important that the Broncos establish that type of physicality and set that type of tone. But it would only happen if the Broncos can get efficient play from this one position, and it's been the position that has been talked about most this offseason. That's the quarterback position. We dive into that next.
Hey, it's Mike Evans. Siltahar Motors is the home of zero down. Regardless of your credit or financial situation, Siltahar Motors will help you get behind the wheel. People with poor credit or in bankruptcy can qualify for zero down and no payments for 45 days and be driving in their new car within hours of stopping by the dealership. Check out any of the cars Siltahar Motors currently has on site at sthmotors.com. Siltahar Motors is conveniently located at Highway 36 in Wadsworth, so regardless of your financial situation, Siltahar Motors will get you the car you deserve at sthmotors.com.
THMotors.com. Hey, Schlereth and Evans. No, I am not Mike Evans. I am Nick Ferguson sitting in for
Please.
Yes. Sitting alongside of Mark Schlereth.
So that way you don't have to do your show tonight then. Are you doing your show tonight?
No, I don't have to do it tonight. Here's what I am doing tonight.
Okay.
I will be down at Ball Arena for game three.
Okay.
So I'll get a chance to see it firsthand, and hopefully it would be the first of many victories in this series for the Denver Nuggets. And I'm expecting a great crowd, of course, but I'm expecting the Nuggets to really come out and show more energy. And not because their head coach has called them out several times, just because they realize that they put in so much work. And yes, Jamal Murray has been out, but you put in so much work and you cannot afford to just allow yourself to be swept by the sun. So I'm expecting some great things. Who are you looking forward to watching tonight turn things around in game three?
Well, I think it really starts with Jokic, right? It really starts with Jokic. And I think when you look at that matchup and what we have seen to this point so far, Jokic hasn't been dominant, and the length of the Suns has bothered Jokic. Ayton has done athletically has done a good job. All you can say about Jokic's first two games is he's been fine. You're the MVP. You can't be fine. You got to be dominant. Like, when I look at, this is something I said after game two, because you were the only show in town, right? You were the only NBA game on. And so all these East Coasters and all these television analysts that really haven't watched the Nuggets other than highlights, the ones that were saying, hey, Jokic begrudgingly, Jokic is the MVP. Okay, we get it, but we don't really agree with it, right? I mean, you gave everybody fuel to the fire because you showed up as the only game in town and you just got your butt whipped. And it was embarrassing. It was an embarrassing loss. And so I think it starts there. Jokic has got to be a dominant player. Michael Porter Jr. has got to be, he has got to be so much better than he's been. He's been so one-dimensional as a 6'11 forward. He's just been so one-dimensional. He's got to be a ton better. I understand that you're overmatched in the backcourt. I get that. I understand that aspect of it. But, those guys have got to be dominant. I think ultimately it starts with Jokic. He can't go 21 points and you got to have 36, 38, and the offense has got to go through you.
Well, he is the reigning MVP of the association, and I've had a chance since the loss of game two talk to a couple of former NBA guys that I know, and I asked them a question. Okay, well, you watched the two games. What have you seen from Nikola Jokic? What haven't you seen? And when it comes to him being the MVP, where's that style of leadership come in? And for the most part, the two guys I spoke to, they were a little upset. They're like, okay, well, Nikola is the MVP. And he's watching his team go down this downward spiral where no one is making shots. At some point, maybe he would say something on the sideline. Maybe there would be some kind of spirited conversation. Because the first name that they brought up, and maybe it's a fair or unfair comparison, was Michael Jordan. how Michael hated to lose, that he was going to be one of those guys that wills his team to victory. So can Nikola actually do it? And is this a little fault that should be shifted to him because he hasn't really led in the way that they needed him to lead?
Yeah, I think that there are some guys, I think he is happy, lucky, go action guy. You know, you tease talking quarterbacks, right?
Yeah.
The Broncos. And, like, when I look at the Nuggets, like, I know beyond the shadow of a doubt, when I watch the Phoenix Sun play, I know who the quarterback is of the Phoenix Suns, right? It's CP3.
Yeah, of course.
Right? He's the quarterback. I think it's tough when you're asking your center to be your quarterback. Right? I think you're playing out of position to some degree, right? It's like, that guy's got to facilitate everything. And, you know, I think you don't truly have a quarterback. Like, right now, the Broncos, you look at the Broncos, kind of the old, when you're in a quarterback battle, or when you have two, you don't have one type of thing. I think that's kind of the way it is. Like, leadership is really interesting to me. Like, the leadership of a football team or the leadership of a basketball team, because there are some guys that just naturally do it, right? They just, that's the way they operate. And then there's some guys that just aren't your natural kind of kick people in the butt and get people going type of thing. Like Von Miller always talks about the leadership he saw from Peyton Manning or the leadership he saw from DeMarcus Ware, but it's never really translated because I think Von is a great player and guys will follow his example as a player, the way he plays. But he is that connective guy, right? The guy that just brings the locker room together. He's fun. I think Nikola is goofy. Like he's maybe not comfortable in that role of like a Chauncey Billups where, you know, Chauncey's going to, you know, yank you by the arm and say, hey man, this is the way we're going to do things. Right. I just don't think necessarily the Nuggets have that on-court guy that really brings that aspect to the team.
So if you don't have that guy, but you do have an MVP, where's that level of leadership come from? Because Jamal isn't there.
Right.
I mean, are you looking for Aaron Gordon to be that guy? Or are you looking for, and Gordon scores 6 points. And after game one, it was said that both Jamichael Green and Aaron Gordon were the two players who just came to the Nuggets that was really giving a spirited kind of dialogue to the players to kind of get them going. So where's that leadership come from? If Nikola can only give that to you by facilitating, where's that extra part of the game that's needed? Where's it coming from?
I don't know that you have the backcourt to get that done. I think last year it was Murray in the bubble, right? The guy that kind of refused to lose type of guy. And I think that's, you know, really what inspired them to come back from, you know, like series deficits that didn't look like they were over, you know, like they were attainable. Like you could come back from a 3-1 deficit twice. So I just don't know that they're made up that way. Injuries and everything have done that. I mean, let's face it. You know, you got a 30-year-old rookie, you know, that's starting at point guard, and you get, you know, 5'9", 30-year-old rookie, and you got a guy that was on the couch in Austin Rivers. And that's not being disrespectful. It's just the facts, right? And so anyhow, these are the type of games that, like, we shall see. Like, Let's throw it on the table. Let's see who takes that role. Let's see if somebody changes things up, or let's just see if you're ready to roll over and start your summer vacation.
We'll see. We'll give our predictions next, and we'll still talk about those Broncos quarterbacks right after this. It is Friday before the big game, but the Broncos have an interesting situation taking place at UCL training facility, a quarterback battle. So it's almost like the Twilight movies. You know, Mark, I don't know if you ever watched the Twilight movies.
I think I saw. I didn't watch the movies. I saw, I think, the first Twilight. I think I saw the first movie, but okay. I don't know how many of them there were, but I think, you know, I think at the time my daughter was, you know, that age where, the little guy that, you know, was like a sex symbol, whoever the star was.
I think it was it Taylor Lautner or something like that?
Yeah. That guy. He was the guy. So everybody wanted to go see him. So I think I went with my daughter and a group of her friends.
Well,
I think I took them, being a good parent that I am.
Well, good for you. But the Broncos seem to have something similar. Like it's either Team Teddy or Team Drew. So with that said, what side are you leaning more towards?
Oh, yeah. I'm leaning toward Team Rodgers when finally Green Bay realizes how bad they've screwed this thing up, and if they're going to get maximum value for him, they need to move him. You know, ultimately, I've been out there, watched a couple of practices and stuff. I've watched enough film. I've covered Teddy, you know, as a last year, a couple games. I did a couple Carolina games last year. So, you know, Teddy's a consummate professional. He's going to be, you know, he's going to know where to go with the football. He's going to know he's going to be on time. He's going to do those things. There are some, call them limitations. You know, there's some things that he stays away from. You know, when it comes to pushing the ball down the field or, you know, ripping one an intermediate throw at 18, 20 yards. Like there's some things that he gets away from. And I don't know if those are necessarily Teddy doesn't want to throw them or, you know, Carolina didn't want to throw them last year. I don't know. I mean, I wasn't in those offensive meeting rooms, so I don't know, but, I think right now early, like the first returns are in. And if you look at early, just OTA aspects, I think certainly from what I've watched in the couple times I've been out to UC Health Training Center to watch practice, Teddy is certainly ahead of the competition, if you will, because of the fact that he's more versed offensively and he gets rid of the ball quicker. When you watch Drew, there's still hesitation. There's still lateness. There's still, you know, you're late with the ball. Being late with the ball creates inaccurate throws. It's just the way mechanics of throwing work. So I just think right now, if you look at that kind of, if that's the battle going on right now, and it doesn't mean it can't change, but right now I think Teddy's ahead of where Drew Locke is.
But all I heard all this offseason was how Drew Locke has been there like every day, how he's been improving, he's been watching film, he's been working with the great Peyton Manning. So at what point do we start to see those type of things show up on the practice field?
Yeah.
So that's always been my question.
Right, which is the $64,000 question, right? I mean, you know, you played for a long time. And we've all played with a guy that is spot on in the meeting room. The guy the first to recognize whatever, you know, guy can answer every question, right?
Until
he gets on the field and then he's lost, right? I mean, I always tell people, man, it never looks the same in the meeting room than it does on the field. And I need guys that can see it on the field and figure it out on the field. So, all that work and all that understanding and all that, you know, preparation and all the things that you're doing, those are all, that's great. And kudos to Drew for doing it. If it doesn't translate to the field, it doesn't matter. I don't care if you can answer every question. Like, I always used to talk about, I used to call them script readers. You know how you get the script before practice?
Yeah.
And guys.
Not that guy.
Right. The guy that will look at every play, like, I know I'm going to be in for plays, you know, 5, 6, and 7. And I'm going to be in plays in first period. I'm going to be in this play 5, 6, and 7. And this period, I'm going to be in this, you know, and we'll, and will completely digest the script and know what's coming up and what blitz potential there is or what pirate stunts coming in. And they'll play that way. And I always used to tell young players that that would look that way, I would go, you know, they don't give you those in games, right?
Right. Nobody, they change things up.
Right. Nobody gives you a script. So I would never look at that stuff, ever. And a lot of the times in practice, because they were managing my health, Mike Shanahan and Alex Gibbs were managing my health, Alex would just shout out to me and go, I need you in play 4, or I need you in play 3. It'd be some, you know, some exotic blitz. And I'd trot in there for play 3, and I'd see what I see, right? And, you know, and I would adjust based on, you know, what I saw, and good, you picked the blitz. Okay, that's, I just wanted you to see that, right? But I would never look at it before I went in to, you know, I want to see it as it unfolds. And there's a skill set that some players just have, and honestly, some players don't. And so can you develop that? Can it get better? Absolutely. But it needs to, like for Drew, it needs to happen. It needs to happen sooner than later.
Would you be surprised if you knew that the Broncos actually did that for Drew, telling him, hey, listen, on this particular play, this is what we're running, throw the ball here, and maybe that has slowed his development?
No, I think with a lot of young players that definitely happens. You're trying to do that, but again, you get into game situations, you know, where you say, hey, you know, when we get into this, this is what they've shown us on film they're going to play. So, you know, this is where we want you to throw the ball. And then all of a sudden you get into it, they show it. And then at the snap, you know, your pre-snap look and your post-snap look are completely different things. And now all of a sudden you're paralysis by analysis, right? Cause you expected one thing, you didn't get it.
And they gave you something else.
Right. And you still throw the ball there, you know, and all of a sudden it's picked or batted down or it's an incompletion. Like that stuff happens all the time. So as a player, you have to develop and you have to be able to read all that stuff. So anyhow, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yo, we'll definitely see what happens. This saga, this drama isn't over yet because we still have your guy. I wonder if he was going to text you. I've been sitting here all morning wondering as you watch your phone,
right,
whether we would receive a text from Aaron Rodgers saying, hey, man, I'm out of here and I'm coming.
You don't mess up, Aaron!
Yeah, I'm coming to Denver. Come pick me up from the airport. But
yeah, I'm. Hey, listen, like you, I'm waiting. Like when I know, you'll know.
But the one thing we don't have to worry about is the game tonight at Ball Arena, Game 3, Suns, Nuggets. It's going down. And I don't know about you, Mark. Here's my predictions for the game.
Yes.
I haven't really seen anything from the Nuggets right away to make me lean their way. I did in Game 2, but I think I'm going to lean towards the Suns tonight. How about you?
Yeah, I'm also going to pick the Suns. I just think, one, CP3 has gained a ton of confidence in this series in his body, which has led to confidence on the court, right? In decisions and everything else. And he has been phenomenal. I think the size, length, athleticism of the Suns, has just been a dominant factor for them in this game, or in this series. Their ability to shoot, and knock down shots has been exceptional. And you know, if the Nuggets choose not to play defense, that's not going to change. I just think there are too many factors. Very much like last night, I thought I picked the Knights to win because there's nothing that the Avs have shown me in Vegas that would make me think they were going to win. You know, make me think that the Avs could overcome that. So I'm the same. There's nothing the Nuggets have shown me to this point that make me think they match up in any way, shape, or form well with the Suns. So I'm taking the Suns.
Well, I hope that both you and I are
wrong. Yes, I
hope
we're wrong too. Yeah.
But coming up next, Big O and Sandy. I know Sandy definitely wants to break down this Avs loss. And Mark, it's been great working with you. Definitely
Absolutely,
appreciate it,
buddy.
Mike, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, man, thanks for allowing me to fill in and see you guys on Monday. Millennial Ben, appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Sandy in Orlando, up next.
Hey, it's Mike Evans. Siltahar Motors understands sometimes bad things happen to good people. That includes bankruptcy. If that is you, you can still purchase a car at Siltahar with zero money down in almost all cases. This is a program they've been doing for 25 years. The dealership itself is almost 60. Family-owned business that is proud of their reputation and proud to be a huge part of the Broomfield community. If you file bankruptcy, Siltahar Motors can help. Zero down and no payments for 45 days in almost all cases. Contact Team Zero Down at 720-446-9222 or online at sthmotors.com.